This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Under presidents of both parties, the U.S. immigration system has long been criticized as overcrowded, backlogged, and broken. And while the broken system has faced new pressures in recent months, the events in our next story began during the Biden administration in 2024. A couple of years ago, the Reverend Dion Johnson and his husband went to Mexico for a green card appointment. Reverend Johnson is the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Missouri. He's now sharing the story of how a routine immigration appointment upended his family's life. His husband, a Mexican national, was forced to spend a year away from his home in the United States. And for the rest of today's show, St. Louis Public Radio's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson has that conversation with Reverend Dion Johnson.
In 2024, you and your husband went to Mexico where he was detained.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, we went for a standard, you know, green card interview with, you know, physical and biometrics and all of that stuff. And he was scheduled for his interview with the immigration officer. And the officer looked through his paperwork, found no deficiencies, you know, no criminal background, no criminal records, no anything, but looked at him and said, "You have not lived in Mexico for most of your life. You need to remain here for the next year." Needless to say, that was devastating for us because we were just expecting a run-of-the-mill, all of his paperwork is in order, but the immigration officers have pretty wide latitude and how they can determine this. I mean, a woman who was in line behind us was told she needed to stay in Mexico for 3 years, having just given birth like 9 months ago.
How did you process that your husband would not be coming home with you?
Well, I went into what do we need to do now mode. The first thing was to get to someplace safe because we recognized that staying in Juarez was just not an option long term. And so we had to find a place where he could be safe, where we could find a place for him to stay, and that was easily accessible from St. Louis that I could get there. And so that was our first piece before anything else. I mean, there were tears. There were lots of tears. But it was, we have a limited window because I had to be back for work with the kids, all that stuff. And so it was, I think we all just went on adrenaline. What do we need to do right this minute? And it wasn't until later, because this happened in January. So it wasn't until when I went to go visit him in February that it actually really hit all of us what was going on. And throughout all of it, he kept saying, "I just want to come home. Because this is home, you know, this is where family is, this is where kids and spouse and friends, and this is where his roots are." And to say, "Oh, well, you need to spend time in Mexico, where's your home?" Culturally, that is his cultural home, but that is not where he has put down roots and lived. And so we did the best that we could with the situation. I mean, thank God for technology. We were able to FaceTime and, you know, have phone calls. And, you know, we would watch movies together as a family with him on FaceTime so that it felt like something normal. But to say that it was a strain on our family, you know, we're now maintaining two households in two different countries with one income. So, I recognize, as always, that I have the privilege of being able to do that. That doesn't mean it wasn't a strain. And I often think of the families. I mean, I think of that lady behind us in line who was told she needed to stay there for 3 years. And then it always ends with the threat, if you go into the country illegally, you'll be barred for 10 years. So, you know, I think of her, that she has a newborn that she will not see until that newborn is 3 years old.
You and your husband have two kids. Mm-hmm. What was that conversation like, explaining to them that their dad had been detained and you didn't know when or if he'd be coming home?
Yeah, that was a really difficult conversation to have. It involved lots of tears. Because to try to explain to a preteen and an early teen that, oh, we went for a routine interview and one of your parents isn't coming back home, potentially at least for a year. And it was a big year for, like, our daughter was going to be turning 15. We were planning for a quinceañera, you know, and we had to cancel doing a quinceañera because he wasn't going to be there. There were lots of life events that we just didn't do for that year because we couldn't. We tried as best we could to incorporate it, but the conversation was really hard to say to, you know, a 14 and 12-year-old at the time, this next year, it's just me. And that was devastating for them. And at the same time, you know, one of them, our son, was able to go with me to go visit a couple of times. But they could feel it. I mean, they knew the difference. They pretty much lost a year with a parent. I mean, again, granted, we had technology to try to be in touch, but it is not the same thing as your parent, like, putting you to bed or, you know, after a long day, giving you a hug. The everyday, ordinary, boring things that we kind of take for granted, all of that disappeared for a year for two young people who were in a formative state in their life. What I think it has done, especially with our daughter, is we've just created two activists because watch out, world, she is going to be a force to be reckoned with. Because A, she's smart, so we can start there. But she has, well, both of our kids have a very ingrained and I think deep sense of justice and injustice. And so they bristle if somebody is being treated poorly because they know what it feels like to not have their parent around. You know, our daughter went to an immigration protest rally where their school walked out because Immigration and Customs Enforcement folks had been coming around the school. And so they decided to do this big walkout in support of their own classmates. And she was one of the people out there kind of going, oh, no, we are going to go burn the whole thing down. Not literally. But we were going to go take on the system and we're going to win. And, you know, my husband and I had been like, well, how about you bring that back just a little bit? You know, we don't need you getting arrested for something because, you know, I'm a Mexican black kid, you kind of look like you don't belong to begin with. So, but I think what it's done for both of our kids is it gave them a deeper appreciation of us as parents, but I think it gave them a deeper sense of this injustice hits home. And so they do a really good job, I think, of standing up for their classmates and for others. And I think they're a little bit more attuned to what's going on in the country because of that experience.
Can you talk a little bit more about how this year-long separation affected them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, at first I think we had to deal a little bit with dropping in grades because both of them had a bit of a drop in grade because, again, we were accustomed to a pattern of, okay, this is when you get a phone call. This is when, you know, you come home from school and this is what this parent does, et cetera. And so the regular routines were completely gone for a year. My job requires me to do a decent amount of travel outside of the diocese, sometimes outside the country. And so having to navigate for me, what am I going to do with, you know, with a kid at school, another one at home, if one of them gets sick? I will say the gift that I was given is I have the most amazing staff and that they allowed me to be a lot more flexible. And same thing with the clergy, that because they knew the situation, I could say, I'm sorry, I can't stay after for the hour-long conversation. I need to get home so that I can be with my family. But I think, I mean, initially it was the drop in grades. And we saw some behaviors, which we shared with the schools that, you know, this is what's going on in their life and whatnot. There was a little bit of acting out early on, at least from our son. And some of that died down or stopped completely when we were all back together underneath the same roof. So, you know, they internalized this. This was not something, you know, this wasn't something that was like theoretical for them. They were living it. And they showed that they were living it.
So as all of this is happening in your personal life, you're also having to navigate this reality as the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Missouri, where there are many people in the churches across the diocese experiencing the same thing.
Yeah.
How did this shape how the diocese is working to protect those who are the most vulnerable right now?
Well, it made it a lot more real, I think, for quite a few folks in across the diocese. I didn't share all the details with the entire diocese. I was very, because I didn't want it to be about, I mean, I still had to do my job. I had to live out my calling. I didn't want me to go visit a congregation and it turned out to be about me. What I did is we shared it with the clergy to ask them for their prayers, for their support. And I asked them not to put it in, you know, the bulletins or on the website or anything like that, because, again, we just did not know what could come out of something very public like that. But it did mean that I had to speak out a little bit more about immigration and what that all meant. And I think what it did is it shaped the diocesan response to the current situation. You know, we have folks, I mean, once he was back here in St. Louis, we were able to share with the whole diocese kind of what was going on. And so it really did spur congregations that I would not have thought of to become and to declare themselves safe spaces for whoever walked in their doors. It's what I think in some ways spurred the beginnings of ministries like Abide in Love, or like we have one congregation that's offering opportunities for legal services. We have clergy who are serving as notary publics for documents and stuff like that. And I think a lot of that came out of the experience of I wasn't a statistic. I wasn't a voiceless, faceless person out in the void that we can say, oh, we can disregard that. I was the bishop of the diocese. And if the bishop is going through this, we're all kind of going through this.
You are also an immigrant. You're originally from Barbados, but you're also a U.S. citizen.
Yes.
How did you ease your kids' worries about the potential of this happening to you?
In the initial conversations, that was a question from one of the kids. You know, well, are they going to come for you? Are they going to make you leave the country? My mother, who is also an immigrant, lives with us, and so she's around to help take care, to help with the kids. Is grandma going to go away? You know, because again, these are the fears that a 12 and 14-year-old are going to have. And so I had to assure her, you know, I'm an American citizen. You know, I'm naturalized. I mean, I am not going to go anywhere. And if they came to try to take me away or something like that, I suspect that, you know, the 10,000 plus people that make up the Diocese of Missouri would have a little bit to say about, you know, us being taken away or something like that. But I had to just, I really had to reassure them that I was not going to be taken away. I had to change my own routine that if I traveled, just before bedtime, I would call to say, you know, hey, this is where I am. I'm safe. I'm getting ready for bed. I hope you all are having a good time to get ready for bed. So, I mean, having to do more of reassurance of you are fine. I am fine. Just keep going. That became a lot of what I had to do for that year. And so even now, like if I'm traveling, I will text to say, hey, I'm on the plane. We just landed. I'm at the hotel. I'm getting ready to head to the airport. I'll see you in 2 hours. You know, that's just now standard for what we do because I think it brings everybody's anxiety down.
That, like, all of that shifts a dynamic of a family.
We live with that shadow constantly. And there are other families out there where that shadow is a lot more prominent. But we have it in the back of our minds, you know, something could shift at any moment. You know, I dread sometimes my phone ringing. Because I'm like, okay, is this somebody calling me to tell me that my husband has been picked up and detained or something? Because again, this is the world we now live in. You know, where people with green cards are being picked up and detained, where U.S. citizens are being picked up and detained. And it just, it feels sometimes like nothing and nowhere is safe. And yet, we still have to live life. I mean, I still live in hope You know, we do the things that keep us grounded where we are, and I think we have a better appreciation of what we have and where we are, because it does feel as though, you know, this could go at any moment, so let's enjoy the moment. I mean, one of our rituals since my husband had been back, I mean, we've been doing this off and on before, but now we do it practically every evening we're home. We will sit out back in the backyard, no matter what the temperature, just to be together and have a wind down and just relax at the end of the day.
Did this moment shake your faith?
No, not really. If anything, it deepened it.
So
I'll tell you a story. I tend to do that, so apologies. I've been doing some research on my family background. And, you know, most slaves don't have, you know, you don't have lots of details of daily life for slave or enslaved people, et cetera. But one of the things that happened in Barbados is that the Church of Latter-day Saints went down there and digitalized all the church records, all the birth records. So we've been able to find great grandparents that we never even knew. And so one of them, I've told this story a couple of times, one of them is a lady named Eliza. And like any other enslaved person, she should have been forgotten by history. Except when one of her children went to be baptized, and there's some detail in here that's important, only her name is listed on the baptism. The father is not listed. Many of the fathers in these documents are not listed. But when she went to have that child baptized, in the baptismal record, the priest wrote a note that said, she has a beautiful singing voice. And I thought to myself, how are you singing in the middle of enslavement? Like, you are considered somebody's property and you can sing. And for me, that singing of hers was a defiant hope. It's even in the midst of all of this. I mean, I think of, you know, she could not have dreamed of one of her descendants being the Bishop of Missouri. And yet here I am. You know, she couldn't dream of that future, but she knew that that future was coming at some point. And my grandmother, her great 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 granddaughter would often say, I mean, I may not know what the future holds, but I know who holds the future. And for me, that's what deepens my faith. Yes, this is terrible. Yes, people are going through all kinds of stuff, and fear is a constant liar. And yet, we know, we've seen this story before. There's always been a pharaoh. There's always been a pilot. There's always been those who have been more in love with power than in love with love. And we know how that story ends. And so for me, I think I've come out of this experience of having that year and even this time of fear to recognize resurrection is going to find us. We're going to practice resurrection. And God is going to have the final word. And I may not see all the change that needs to happen in our society and in our world, but I can do my part to, you know, to push us a little bit further, a little bit closer to that beloved community.
That's the Reverend Dion Johnson, the Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Missouri, talking with STLPR's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. We need to take a quick break. When we return, we'll have more of their conversation about how a routine immigration appointment in Mexico upended Reverend Johnson's family's life in 2024. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
Welcome back. I'm Elaine Cha. Let's return to STLPR afternoon newscaster Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson's conversation with the Reverend Dion Johnson. The Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Missouri is now sharing the story of how his husband was forced to live in Mexico for a year, starting in 2024, after a routine immigration appointment, and how that upended their lives.
There is good news in this story.
Oh, there's always good news.
He made it back. Your husband made it back to St. Louis last year.
On Valentine's Day.
Really?
February 14th. Go figure.
How did that all happen?
Well, so that's a funny story. So his birthday is in February. And so I decided, I happened to see a last-minute flight to Mexico, and so I decided, you know what? I'm going to surprise him for his birthday and not tell him. I'm just going to show up at the door of the apartment and, you know, give him a big surprise. And so I made all the arrangements, booked the plane ticket. You know, we did our usual morning call and check-in. And I said, well, I'm going to be really busy today, so I'm not going to get a chance to call you throughout the day. I mean, I'll talk to you later in the evening when I get back. And, you know, that was the plan. Said to our son, oh, I'm headed to the airport. You know, I'll see you in a couple of days. Well, my husband had called my son to say good morning. And then he says, oh, did Dad leave already? And my beloved 12-year-old goes, no, Dad went to the airport. And I'm like, so of course, you know, he began to put two and two together. I mean, I'm in the cab on my way to go see, you know, from the airport in Mexico to the apartment. I'm in the cab, my husband's messaging like, so what were you going to the airport for? I'm like, oh, well, I had to go pick something up. Because I'm dropping something off. Yeah, it's related to your birthday. No, I'm trying my best not to lie here.
And your son already partially exposed.
Yes, exactly.
The surprise.
So it was just kind of like, keep your mouth shut, 12-year-old. But hey. But anyway, I mean, I got there. We had gone in January to Juarez to, you know, do the final paperwork, and they said they took his passport, they took all of his stuff and said, you know, we'll get back to you. So we had done all of that. And while we were there, the day after his birthday, I got an email saying there's been an update on your case. And so I said to him, I think they may have said or done something with your processing your green card. And my husband, ever the skeptical one, goes like, no, I don't think so. I'm like, you might want to go check your email. If they're sending me an update, I mean, it's going to tell us you've been approved or not. And so we took a look, and it says visa granted. And, I mean, at first it was just complete disbelief. I mean, he was just like, I don't believe it. I'm like, it's telling you that your visa has been granted. And I mean, we literally had to refresh the browser like six times before he could recognize like, yeah, this really is happening. And we sent in the stuff that where they were going to send back his passport with his visa. And they told him he had 30 days once you get the passport back to re-enter the country and all that stuff. And so before I even left, I booked the plane ticket. I was like, nope, we are booking this plane ticket. You're going to get your visa on, you know, you're going to pick it up from the, they're going to deliver it on Thursday. You're going to be on a plane on like as soon as possible after that. And so, no, I think he came back on like a Tuesday or something like that. But it was, I was there. I went home, got everything ready, and picked him up at the airport a couple days later.
How did you break that news to your kids?
Well, I didn't. I just said, you're going to get a surprise later this week. Because again, just in case something happened with the flights or whatnot, I just did not want to create this, oh yeah, Poppy's coming home. Well, now it's going to be a couple of days later or something. So when I picked him up from the airport is when I let my mother know, like, okay, you can say he's here. You can tell them why.
What was their reaction when he came home?
I think they were through the moon, over the moon and through the roof. And he, I think, was a little bit overwhelmed because what I did is I organized a couple of our close friends to come by so we could just have a very simple dinner. I'm the extrovert. My husband's very much an introvert. He can do limited people. But, you know, being in Mexico for a year by yourself, you know, you walk back into your home, it feels different because you've not been there for a year. And so we had this little dinner and whatnot. And after a while, I just had to say to everybody, okay, time for y'all to go. He just needs to just be and I think at that point, that's when he broke down, that it's like, it doesn't quite feel real that he's back home.
Help me to understand, what was it about him not living in Mexico long enough in comparison to living in the States for as long as he had been?
Yeah. We don't know. When he went back for, you know, he spent the year in Mexico. When he went back to actually get his second interview, so we had to do the physical all over, like all the things had to be done all over again. When he went to meet with the officer this time, she looked at him and said, "Why did you take so long to go do your green card paperwork and to come in for your interview?" And he said, "Well, one of your officers told me I needed to stay in Mexico for a year." And I can quote what she said, "That doesn't make any sense. You have no reason for us to make you do that." So like I said, a lot of this is just left up to the discretion of the officer. And unfortunately, if you're going through this process, there's no, officer number 345 or something like that. It's just officer. There's no identifying marks for which officer you've been working with.
That is quite the journey from doing baseline paperwork to make sure everything was good.
Yeah.
You're stuck in a place
that you do not know.
That you do not know. Hmm? Where his family is not, like the area in which he was stuck, his family was not there. Mm-hmm. And he hadn't really lived there since he was a child, correct?
Yeah. So he moved from Mexico when he was about five or six.
And so as an adult, he does not know this place.
Nope.
To the agent being like, "I don't know why you're still here."
Yeah. Well, that's the piece that we kept, I mean, I'll be honest, it just peed me off when that agent said that. Here he was stuck for a year, and all the paperwork in the system said he should have been granted his green card the first time we came. I mean, it made me so angry that someone could be that arbitrary with other people's lives. Mm. It's what keeps me angry sometimes about what's going on now. The callousness in which immigrants and people who are just seeking the same thing that every other person running around the United States is seeking for, life, liberty, and a pursuit of happiness. You know, if we're going to live into that, we can't callously just disregard the dignity of humanity.
You're in a unique position as the Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Missouri, but you're also an openly gay immigrant married with children.
It's a mouthful.
It is. And with that, why was it important for you to share your family's story?
We have an incarnate faith. Our faith is about the incarnation. It's about God becoming human. And many times I think what happens is that we can caricature, you know, "Oh, this is what a gay person is supposed to look like," or "this is what an immigrant is supposed to look like." And so to be incarnate, to be bodily present, you know, to show up. You know, my grandmother had this wonderful line that to be successful in life, you do three things: get up, dress up, and show up. And sometimes just showing up is enough to change the narrative. I can tell you stories of congregations that me being called to be their bishop was going to be a challenge, until I actually showed up and they recognized, he loves Jesus just as much as we do. He cares for us as much as we care for each other. He's invested in us. And so, you know, I have had conversations. I mean, I had someone who came up to me and said, "I voted for this current administration and I want to understand your story as an immigrant." And, you know, by the time we were done sharing our conversation, they said to me, "I really wish I had talked to you before. I would not have voted the way that I did." So part of me being able to share my story and being able to say, "This is who I am," is to demystify all of those stereotypes that people have as much as I can. But also to remind people that, you know, when you hear the word immigrant, we're not just talking about some nameless, faceless group of people. When you hear a gay person, you're not talking about some nameless, faceless. You're talking about actual people who have lives, who deserve the same dignity, the same aspirations that you have. We are all desiring that same thing. I mean, I said to one of my friends the other day, most people are going to realize that gay couples are just as boring as any other straight couple. You know, we do the same things. But for me, being present, showing up, showing up in the spaces that I'm not supposed to show up in. That's been really important because I want people to actually see I'm not a statistic. I'm not a caricature. I'm actually a real person who is trying to do the best that I can to, you know, love my family, love myself, and to follow this Jesus.
That's Dion Johnson, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Missouri, talking with STLPR's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson about how his husband's routine immigration appointment in Mexico in 2024 upended their family's life for a year.
This episode was produced by Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson.
Audio editing by our executive producer, Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.